This is Roger Molina on Creative Disturbance. I'm here today with Marcus Neustadter. Marcus, maybe you could just present yourself quickly and what you do, and we're going to discuss the Rocket Factory in Johannesburg.
Thank you, Roger. Yes, Marcus Neustadter, Johannesburg-based artist and kind of cultural activist, experimenting a lot in the space of arts, science, and technology and the spaces in between. And I'm quite active in the transformation of some of Johannesburg's public spaces and some of the buildings in Johannesburg, and one of them is called the Rocket Factory.
Right, and that, you know, when you told me about that, that attracted my attention because, as you know, my father was a rocket pioneer in the 1930s. I myself worked as a space scientist flying things on rockets, so I'm a second generation rocketeer. And so rockets are sort of part of my cultural history. And it kind of intrigued me that maybe in Johannesburg once they were building rockets. So what's the story?
Well, apparently they were once building rockets in Johannesburg, or so at least we want to believe. We started an urban legend.
So you're the originator of this urban myth?
Yes, I am. The developer from that we work with closely, Jonathan Liebman, was walking through the neighborhood and just proudly showed me that he bought this new building. And on top there's a chimney stack that looks like it should be a rocket. And so I said to him, that looks like a rocket. This should be a rocket factory. And suddenly the media picked up on it, and it became known that there was a rocket factory in this area of Johannesburg.
So this converted factory building is going to be residential, and it's called the Rocket Factory. Tell us a little bit about how you've been making that urban myth come alive.
My role is really to take elements of the Rocket Factory and see how I can simulate something that could have been a factory that produced rockets. But the idea is not to make something that actually looks like it, but rather that just emulates it and plays with it in a creative way. So using all the trash that comes from the building, all of the old steel parts from the factory that was actually there, which was in fact a tire factory, I am taking those elements, repurposing them, rebuilding them as rocket parts and putting them back into the building itself, so that the public spaces start to become animated with objects that are standing around and reminds one of this rocket factory that used to be there.
So you're building space junk out of recycled materials. And so, you know, the intriguing idea is maybe 100,000 years from now, future archaeologists will be digging up Johannesburg and they'll find these rocket parts.
Well, the funny thing is I was actually working with the observatory in Johannesburg and they have some space junk on exhibition. And right next to the space junk section, there's old paraphernalia that are used for educational purposes of rockets that they built for schools and things to show them how these things could work. And they just trashed them there next to the space junk and they actually look like space junk. And that's where the idea came from, to actually take everyday recycled material that might be strange, that you can't quite recognize what it is, combine it with other things, and then start to create your own space junk, because it really is that space of the imaginary, you know, what it could look like.
Yeah. And you told me actually that you've actually placed some of this space junk in the Cradle of Humanity.
Yes. So in the Cradle of Humankind, just north of Johannesburg, a UNESCO World Heritage Site, now has a bunch of space junk that we're not quite sure if it really comes from space or not.
Did they authorize you to put it there?
Fortunately enough, there's an art lover who owns part of the land who's been very supportive, and it's part of a show that's happening there. And similarly, at the same time, I'm working with archaeologists in that area, looking at some of the kind of important finds, and taking photographs not only of the finds, but more importantly of the cave openings and the portals, and then building sculptures around these portals. Again, looking at, a different type of a telescope or an observatory that looks into space.
So you work in archaeological sites, and you work in astronomical sites, which we'll talk about a little bit more maybe. Connects to your idea of the vertical gaze in the imaginary. You want to talk about that a little bit?
Well, both working with archaeologists and astronomers, I realize that I'm looking back in time and I'm having conversations about the past, even though we're thinking about the future. and that, for me, this vertical gaze was looking up back in time, looking down back in time, means I started to more and more wonder where I exist in the now. You know, that slither of the now becomes thinner and thinner when you really start thinking about it. And how proactive one needs to be in the now to think about, you know, the next steps. So we know this about environmental crises. We know this about issues around space journeys of the future, you know, how we're going to colonize, let's say, the space. So this moment of the now really fascinates me, because we're using that as our point of departure to look into other spaces and into other futures.
And what better place than Africa to look back 100,000 years and look forward 100,000 years? And
yes.
So
That's why I live there.
I'm really intrigued by this idea of this vertical gaze, which is both looking into the past and looking in the future, and it kind of situates the now in that big context. And as you just referred earlier today, we did a Skype with Rajani Spitz and her students in Rio de Janeiro, and they were talking about the question of human migration. And somehow this is really an African relevant question.
Mm-hmm. Well, the interesting part, if you start looking at the patterns of migration across Africa, both in the early days and now, you know, the kind of Central and West Africans trying to get to Europe and landing in the oceans before the Canary Islands, you start realizing the desperation that comes from looking for greener pastures on the other side, you know, kind of trying to follow those and colonized one once to make the connections to those new sense of aspiration. And so this, the sense of aspiration and drive towards finding something new is an interesting one. But if you don't have the infrastructure and the rocket science, so to speak, to take you into these new spaces that we can now occupy, when asked the question, what is that new space that you can, that you need to fight for and protect? And with China colonizing a lot of Africa in interesting ways, one really needs to think about how we hold on to our cultural identity and our cultural past and preserve it going to the future. And as you know, the universities and the museums around Europe and North America are full of African artifacts that represent Africa's past. And now we've got a new wave of a different cultural influx. And I really wonder how these migration patterns are going to really start eradicating some of our really valuable oral histories, our reflections on the stars, for example, by the Khoisan, which are already lost. And so my questions are also about the here and the now and how we need to preserve what's currently going on.
Okay, so I want to fork this discussion in two directions. So I don't know quite how we're going to do this. So one direction is that a lot of your arts practice is socially engaged, and so I think part of this rocket factory, you've also involved the people who live around that building now, who are very diverse group of people, from Senegalese to Nigerians to South Africans. So part of it, one of the ideas that you have is indeed how this building embeds its recent past and its real neighborhood. The other direction I want to take this on then is you've done also socially engaged work with the South African Large Telescope and the observatory base there. And there you got into some interesting discussions about the local and the global, if you want, and another version of the vertical gaze, where in fact the astronomers were very disconnected from the local community that observatory is in. So I don't know how we want to weave these two directions together.
Well, I think they're probably the same thing, because essentially it comes down to working in a context-specific way and allowing the communities that surround a development. It could be an observatory, it could be a new building in Johannesburg, you know, how these communities that have occupied space for so much time before someone came to take occupation of that space should be informing some of our thinking around how we occupy and how we design spaces. So to allow this building in the city to permeate the local users to move in and out in a free way and take ownership of it so that they can be proud of this rocket factory is just as important as local communities that live at the foot of this grand observatory in the center of South Africa. They should have access to this data. They should have access to the facilities. But actually what's happening is there's a lot of alienation that happens. And so the debate with the scientists, much like the debate with the developer of this new building, is how do you break down these barriers and these walls that unfortunately I think Western development strategies have put up just simply because we have no other solutions.
Okay, so this is the first time I've heard astronomers being accused as part of the gentrification process of the planet. and I guess it's the first time I thought about it that way. And indeed, continuing battle for these observatories is they need to be in pristine sites with no light pollution. The last thing they want is urban development around the observatory site. They want radio silence in the case of radio telescopes, and so the last thing they want is a lot of radio stations.
But unfortunately, that darkness and silence that they're looking for is considered in some of these small towns in the Karoo where this observatory is as a sign of, of forgottenness, of hopelessness, of fear, of crime, of all kinds of ills that come from a legacy of a very complex past in South Africa. So scientific development doesn't necessarily make space for healthy local development of gentrification, I guess, but in a strange way. But what fascinates me there is that there are a lot of observatories, and this is just coming back to the Johannesburg Observatory, which is quite close to the rocket factory. Some of these scientific spaces are no longer being used as scientific spaces. Yes, amateur astronomers are dabbling in the space and experimenting, but actually I've always had this impression that the telescope should be shifted downwards and actually we look at what's around that observatory, because you know these neighborhoods are really complex, dangerous, difficult spaces that are just being that surround these islands of scientific research that aren't even being used anymore for scientific research. And so often I think observatories and the notion of what observatories did for many in the past need to consider what they do for people of today, and that there is a different vertical gaze that looks down and not just up or at the now.
Right, and so that's part of this vertical gaze sort of concept that you've been talking about. I guess a different angle attack on that question I have, and I know you got into conflicts and two-year negotiations with the observatory director and stuff in order to actually build a small cultural observatory on the same site. But I'd like to connect it to a larger discussion. I think, as I mentioned to you before, there's a researcher called Helga Novotny, who is the president of the European Research Council, who has written quite a lot about the need to create a socially robust science. And indeed, most scientists, and I'm one of them, kind of view that their job is to educate the planet, the public. So it's an education problem. And the scientists don't think there's a negotiation that's needed between the public and themselves. And so, you know, clearly a telescope observatory site doesn't need any defense, right? Why should we be negotiating with the local inhabitants about the use of that mountaintop? Obviously, this is a huge topic in Hawaii, which is also a site that's religiously sacred to certain people who live in Hawaii. And so there's been a lot of friction between the observatory staff and the surrounding population. So maybe you can just talk about that a little bit, of that negotiation.
Well, the negotiation is really interesting because the translation of the scientific approach at the observatory to something that the community can have an access to is quite important, especially in the again, it comes down to context and history. You know, in a place where the white South African, I'm going to be very blunt about this, marginalized the colored community and made them dependent on them, and now there's again the Westerner, the white, the foreigner building these telescopes and observatories, which yes are sanctioned by a government and yes are being funded by local taxpayers, but at the same time,
although there's a Japanese telescope too,
so. There's a Japanese one. Yeah, exactly, good point. There's a range of telescopes, but the concept is still that there's the foreigner that's building something that is for the pursuit of a knowledge system that is not embedded in the local knowledge needs, call it that. And so the debate is more about trying to shift those boundaries, make it a soft edge and not such a hard edge that says we're doing science and you do community research and community projects, but rather to say, look, the two can meet somewhere and there is a soft space. And I must say, while we've struggled to, on some levels, with some individuals at the observatory, acknowledging what we do creatively to break that down that boundary, there have been others that have welcomed us. So one can't say it's an all or nothing situation, but I do think that
and certainly I subscribe to this idea that science establishments need to be entered into real negotiation with the communities around them, on both on the local scale and the global scale. And I think, you know, what this becomes in your practice is really a creation of a hybrid culture in some way, which not only takes the past and the future, but the local and the global, and tries to make it meaningful in a particular context. For me, the rocket factory is almost a great symbol of this hybrid culture that you're trying to build.
It's the best part about the rocket factory was taking those people that have bought into the rocket factory, the people that have bought the apartments, through a construction site where they literally were walking around as if they were on another planet. And I really enjoyed that, because using a bit of light, smoke machines, and the rubble that was just lying around, most of them came out thinking that they'd actually taken the rocket somewhere else, and for a moment we're kind of walking on another planet. And that kind of shift of perception and experience from a really complex inner city Johannesburg to something that elevates you to another place, even though you're walking around rubble and rubbish, is a bit of the magic that I think we need to sometimes escape the realities.
Okay, excellent. Thank you, Marcus. I think we've been creatively disturbed.
Thank you, Roger. So have I.